Welcome to the Great Security Debate. This show has experts taking sides to help broaden understanding of a topic. Therefore, it's safe to say that the views expressed are not necessarily those of the people we work with or for. Heck, they may not even represent our own views, as we take a position for the sake of the debate. Our website is greatsecuritydebate.net, and you can contact us via email at feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net or on Twitter @securitydebate. Now, let's join the debate already in progress.
The Great Resignation. Like, you could be at a great company, You could be at a company that has great technology. You could be given a lifeline of stock and everything else. But at the end of the day, if your misery, right, is that bad, why would you stay?
Right.
And I think, go ahead, Eric.
No, I was going to say, but it kind of harkens back to the advice we give new students going into college, right? Don't pick your career based on how much money you're going to make. Pick it on what your passion is, the money will follow. It's kind of the same analogy, right?
Well, the difference though being, and you could almost put this towards universities of when you decide where you're going to go to school. Everyone told me that. They told you that. They told a lot of people that. But then you get into your career and you kind of get stuck for a little bit. And then the only jobs you take are jobs within 45 minutes of wherever you ended up settling. Right? Unless you decide that you're going to pack up and move. But the people that packed up and moved were like less than 5%. I mean, the people that worked at my company for 16 years. Mm-hmm. But now that's completely changed. Now it's like, you know what? I could look for something further away. I could go to a company that has this culture. I always wanted to work for this startup, but I was never going to pack up and move to California or move to here. Right? And now I could work for them. And if things are really good, I may move because I love the people. You know, like John is my boss, the best guy in the world. Honey, we should move to Austin because wouldn't it be great to be with him and his wife and closer to them, right? People gravitate towards that.
Yeah. No, they definitely do. And they definitely are. And I think this is the time, just as an aside, I think this is the time of year when many of them are realizing the tax implications of some of their snap decisions as they move to new locations and didn't necessarily account for the taxes of where they are going to be. But that's a different story and one for your accountant and you to talk about, not necessarily the three of us. But I guess I want to go back to the start of the problem. You know, you go to a company, let's go back to the days in which everyone was in a company for long periods of time, 20, 30 years, and your entire salary future is based on the decision you make the first day that you arrive. You come, you get set with the salary, and everything from there on out is 3%, 4%, 2%, 6% based on that original number. And that original number is, has always been very mythical. People, at least in the US, don't talk about salary. They don't talk about what they make. They don't talk about what they do. So there's kind of this air of mystery of we don't know what we should be asking for. We don't know if we're getting a good rate. Now, today there's moves in some states, Colorado being the first one, to make transparency of what the range of jobs is. But you walk in the door and you don't necessarily know what it is that, if you're getting a good deal or not. The company knows, but you don't necessarily know. So the question I asked earlier and one I'd love to cover today is the pros and cons, the fors and againsts of having some representation in your salary negotiations, meaning, for lack of a better term, getting an agent and having them negotiate for you based on a lot of information. There was a TechCrunch article that I'll put in the show notes that is a little interesting. You know, it's about this, and it starts to equate, does the Great Resignation then facilitate the need for representation similar to that which we see in Hollywood?
Yeah, it's an interesting topic, but it also, I think we got to start out and talk about, because it's not applicable to everybody, right? It's going to be dependent on where you are in your career. I mean, for instance, if we were to go down the hole and say, all right, everybody should get an agent, a representation, but if you're coming out of college, it's not I wouldn't say that's necessarily applicable, right? Because we're talking about a smaller range. Those are pretty well known wage ranges and all of that. But what I want to draw back to is an earlier episode that we had where we talked about the importance of networking. So I think that is number one, whether that we're talking about somebody getting representation with the negotiations, all of that, networking becomes so powerful because you can bounce the different ideas off of individuals. I know, you know, Dan, you and I certainly in the past have had some of those conversations on where mm-hmm. others are on direction. If you try to go it alone, you're missing a lot of different angles.
So not to take away from what you were saying, Eric, but I was looking at this, Dan, when you brought up the conversation. You could actually make an entire business out of this. If you think about when did people start using agents, and I'm not talking about the idea that mid-career employees were using agents. I'm talking about sports stars. I'm talking about, you know, musicians, et cetera, using agents and negotiating these big, big contracts because they were worth millions and millions of dollars. But now imagine the volume of people, right? And the contract negotiations aren't year-long contract negotiations for a multi-million dollar, you know, lefty, you know, or Max Scherzer, you name the guy, right? You could be doing 1 to 2 week negotiations for someone who's making between $300,000 and $400,000 with additional benefits. And if you rinsed and repeated this, you could be doing 3 or 4 of these at a time, times 2 a month, 8 times 12, 96 of them a year.
Live math, right? On the show, ladies and gentlemen.
And just figure out the percentage there that you'd be walking away with, and you could make a good business out of it. And I think there is room to say why it is important, because if one, you look at that resignation rates are highest amongst mid-career employees. And I'll pull where I'm getting this information from, because I was literally reading some articles and that's where I was pulling this from, Dan. So I'll share it in the show notes.
Okay.
So then the second, resignations are highest in the tech and healthcare industries. And if that's true in the tech side, then I would imagine that, and this is Brian, this isn't part of the article I was reading, that about 50% of those people in tech are more introverted. And the idea of having to negotiate with HR, who's ever going to be their boss, is not something they're comfortable with. So having an agent step in there and being able to fulfill that gap could be not only beneficial for the tech person, but also very beneficial for the agent itself. And although the company might look at that and be like, that's the last thing we want to do. You know, every time an agent comes in, we end up paying more. You pay for what you get. And I hate to say it, a lot of your company valuations in the tech business are valued at $1 billion or greater. You guys have the resources, the people to look at numbers, to run them and say, this is what we're going to do. You have a team of people that work on negotiating against this one individual, right? So I don't know. I'm kind of on the side of the agent.
Yeah. And the idea that just to correlate those two, you know, Eric, you mentioned the networks and then Eric, Brian, you mentioned the introversion, and those two things are counter to each other. These two important right. things. So then, you know, putting it in the hands of a third party to be able to help call, I mean, this, it's the same as, I guess it's almost a play on the idea of taking a recruiter who most times, at least again, here in the US, work on behalf of the hiring side. There are recruiters that work on the side of the employee, of the job seeker, and do some of that combination between, you know, using their network to get you into the right, to get your face and name into the right place, but then taking it one step further and also doing that negotiation. It's not happening a lot. And Eric, I argue that doesn't necessarily limit to only the, you know, middle and higher level offerings. I think it could go all the way down. I think there is no reason it can't. Will it right away? Absolutely not. But I think it could, and it'd be very interesting, especially if there is a huge gap in workers. I mean, a need for work, for people to work in those entry level jobs, and not enough people. Now you could also replace the word agent with union in that case. You could, you know, there's a lot of interchangeability in how that might actually play out at different levels, but representation doesn't necessarily have to be for the higher levels only.
And real quick, Dan, I haven't read through this article yet, but as you were just talking, there was an article by NPR that said the great resignation is more like the great renegotiation. And I the title itself, yeah. I was like, couldn't have been more, you know, relative to this conversation.
Yeah, I've read this article from a few days ago. And so put in the show notes, it's actually a really good mirror to what it is we're doing. It's people, you know, it is as much as the conversation comes to the great resignation is not just about money. It is becoming more and more about money as much as it is the other things. You know, we're seeing record inflations in the US, around the world, actually. We're seeing costs soaring, and we're seeing stagnation in salaries. So people are saying, we've got to figure out how to be able to continue to live and do the thing we like to do and do this job. And so there is a lot of renegotiation that's happening. And on the flip side, you have companies having fear of losing their key staff. And so some are proactively going out and saying, we're going to go larger. I can't remember who it was, might have been IBM, but I'll check that and include the piece in the notes. But there was somebody who proactively said, look, we're going out, we're going to make some rises across the board in 2022 as a way to try and keep people. And, you know, they just went out and did it because they knew that it was going to become a problem.
Right.
So yeah, dollars are very much at the heart of it, but they're still not the only thing.
That's what I was going to say. I think the calling it the great resignation is doing it a disservice. I think it's the great realization, because what you have, and I forget what the article is, and I apologize, I'll try to dig it up, but I was reading somewhere that was going through leadership. And, you know, I think a lot of what we're talking about pertains to kind of the white collar office jobs and all of that, but you're seeing the same thing in blue collar type jobs. I mean, if we just look at the restaurant industry, that you mm-hmm. see a lot of churn where people were working from home or were at home for a while, come back and go, well, wait, it's kind of like a reset. Things that you accepted, whether it be lack of leadership, management, bad management styles and all of that, it reset it. And as people walk back into the workplace, start to look around and realizing, oh, wow, yeah, I was okay with this. I don't want this anymore. I'm going to go do something else. So I think you've got a whole component of that, but I think that plays into the renegotiation, people kind of resetting and going, all right, well, these are the expectations for me. Compensation, whatever it is now not in line with what the expectations are.
Yeah. And the fact that we're 3 weeks away from 3 to 5 weeks away from you get back to the white collar crowd from most bonuses being paid. And I'm now hearing quite a lot of rumblings of people who are ready to give that notice as soon as that's in hand. But you know, just to counter your point there, Eric, many of them are saying, you know what, I'm just not going back. It is a realization, but it is very much a resignation. It's not, I'm not looking to go something else. It's not worth it for me.
You're talking about exiting the workforce altogether.
Exiting the workforce altogether, which is unprecedented in just in my own unscientific empirical clinical trial here. It's an unprecedented level of people who are not saying I'm going to go back and find something else. It's I'm done. I've amassed what I need to. I'm just going to go and chill out for a while.
On that note, I wanted to circle to the inflation portion of the conversation, because one of the highlights in the articles talked about that, you know, even though certain hospitality and leisure saw their hourly earnings increase by 12.3% in November, well outpacing inflation, and despite all the quitting and renegotiation, that the real wage for the average American worker, meaning the true value of their paycheck after taking inflation into account, had fallen by 2.4%. I think that's important to recognize, because when we're talking about, and Eric, you had mentioned this and alluded to it, not even alluded to it, just referenced it, that coming back to work, people looked at their value and everything else, in, as well as inflation, and said, I need to be paid more. But what we're not talking about is the fact that the people who are shareholders in these companies look at what they believe is their perceived value for having ownership in the company, and that regardless of paying you more, then the cost of goods must go up to reaccount for the fact that they have a certain level of profitability that they still are not go. They don't care. The goods cost more. The consumer needs more money. Price goes up. We need to see a certain bit of profitability. And this goes back to articles, and I harken back to 5-6 years ago when a lot of these big companies got together after the downturn and said, we need to relook at the idea of what value we're providing. Is it shareholder value or value back to the employees?
Yes. Oh, the business roundtable?
Business roundtable, yes. Change that.
And we really need to start saying that the employee comes first. And when you do that, the customer will automatically be first in the employee's eyes.
Right.
If it's always about the shareholder, and that was, I forget the book there that we were reading about or talking about. Yeah. You read about there, and you could just take the difference between each CEO. And when the new one steps in, and what he talks about in that first opening statement will define in your head the character of the person and what they value most, his employee and the customer, or the shareholder, then customer, then employee.
Right. I think that's a great point, Brian. And I actually think as we go into March, as we go into bonus season, you're going to start to see some companies struggle. Those companies that are beholden to shareholder value, and that's what they live for. It's the quarter-to-quarter metrics, the revenue and stuff like that. I think you're going to see some of them start to struggle because now you've got this employee base that wants to identify with more. And we've seen this, right? If we go back into generational, you know, Gen Z, millennials, and speaking for a millennial, it's value-based organizations that these groups that we're starting to see people want to gravitate towards, right? You have to have a meeting. You have to have something that ties back to society. And I think a lot of organizations have done a great job. You know, if we talked about DEI here, as organizations are focusing on that, and those organizations that hold on, that actually embrace it and run with it rather than being a checkbox activity, I think you're going to continue to see them start to grow because they're going to have the propensity to have a greater pick of the talent because there will be a natural connection given their mission.
Yeah. We just had a interesting discussion about this on a MentorCore recording around the rise of ESG, the environmental, social governance within organizations, and the way that people buy, the way that companies buy, even B2B, is increasingly tied to that, you know, how a company deals with their social obligations and the world around it. So yeah, I mean, and that is purely driven by, like you said, some of that generational drive toward making investments, making purchases that align with someone's core ethics and values.
What's interesting is this, I actually think this shift gets us actually closer to the free hand and the idea that an open market regulates itself based on consumer spending, right? If consumers don't identify with an organization, don't like what they're doing, they vote by the share of their wallet and they go somewhere else. So we might be on kind of the leading edge of this and seeing that shift back to what the free market is supposed to be, not to go down the economics rabbit hole. But you know, I was going to ask the question. So going back to the agent, no agent, is there precedence for this? I mean, do we see this with your other roles of a CEO, CFO, COO, CMO? Have they historically been using agents? I don't know the answer to that.
Dan, I was going to say, and give the definition of what the agent could be, because is the agent actually a representative who's getting paid to represent the person? Or is the agent just a spokesperson on your behalf who could be a mentor? So I'm taking, Eric, your question, then asking Dan to define what the agent is and then answer the question.
Yeah. I mean, are there Scott Borises, the equivalent of Scott Boris in these, you know, super agent to the sports stars in this field? No, but there definitely is help. There's definitely help in others. But it's not necessarily always as explicit as, hi, I'm Dan and I represent Eric and you'll need to talk to me. But it's much more, I think it's much more on the mentoring side. It's much more on the advisory. Here's what we do. And if you have that headhunter, that recruiter that is shopping you as a candidate, you get a different, that's part of that as well. They're helping to give you advice and say, I think you should take this, or I think you shouldn't. They are often the ones doing that kind of conversation with the candidate company. So yeah, so to some extent, yes, it does exist, but it's not used because, again, they take a fee on top of the salary, or they take a part of the salary. And that's not necessarily feasible to people at all levels.
What I was going to add to what you were saying there too is, because I, for all the listeners, you hear the word agent, and what I was referring to in the very beginning was the idea of actually somebody that was like a Boris, somebody that did it as a profession, and could come in and represent, you know, a few hundred people a year in the technology field to help get them jobs. And I'm not talking about recruiters. That's completely different, right? I'm talking about someone, because recruiters help negotiate your salary and everything else, but are they really your agent, right? Are they someone that's going to check back in on you, you know, in 3 months and 6 months? And now I flip to what Dan was referring to, and that could be when somebody talks about an agent of change, right? Like, you work at a company, you believe the culture needs to be improved. And something my father used to always say is, Brian, you should try to be the agent of change, right? And that's working internally to do things where you yourself try to show through your actions how to change culture. And now I'm going to take that to the step where I was going to say, so instead of being the Boris, the agent, sometimes the agent is what you were talking about, Eric, which is the idea of networking. You're interviewing for a position. And this is where I think when we talk about tech positions, if 50% of the people are introverted, I'm just throwing out that number. So for all the listeners, that was a Brian Schneebly made up number. Just say 50%.
You'll find it in no actual text.
Yeah. Anyway. I was trying to look it up and nobody can confirm that that number exists, but let's just say that 50% are introverted. Then the idea of doing sales, in when people say it's not always what you know, but who you know, is very, very true. In the security field, there's a lot of people that know each other. And I'm not talking from a sales role, I'm talking from an actual practitioner role. So when you're interviewing for a position and you see that somebody is connected to somebody, and one of the people is your friend, and the other person is someone you're interviewing with at the company or in representation at the company, reach out to your friend and say, hey, I'm talking to this said company B, and we're in the position of negotiating, and I really feel uncomfortable about this. Do you have any advice for me? Or B, would you mind reaching out to so-and-so to talk to him on my behalf, right? And most people, I think, do want to do that for you, because everyone wants the best for each other when those people are all in the same, either A position or in the same, how do you say that, that group, right? That in Japanese terms, we referred to it as doki, right? Like, you were all in the same class together, right? Coming up through the ranks together. So you all looked out for each other. People want to do that for you. That could be your agent of change.
It's interesting. I mean, so flip the script here and look at it from a different angle. And so look at it from the HR, the hiring practitioner side. You know, does it raise any questions that, hey, if you need to bring somebody in on your behalf, is there a lack of skill? Is there something missing that you yourself can't negotiate on your behalf?
And with that being said, I would hire Dan to come in and negotiate on my behalf.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, I guess it's easy. And well, there. So, Eric, to your question, I think there's a lot of things that people don't know about what they don't know. And True. Having somebody in the middle who does, who sees it, you know, for the same reason you go to Gartner, to go to Forrester, to say, help me look at my contracts with this tech supplier. You see a lot of these contracts. You understand what's in them, what's good, what's bad. Am I overpaying? Am I underpaying? Am I getting royally taken for a bath? You know, having somebody who knows that and can be that is, there's a lot of value in that. And that's right. The part that's been the mystery and the cloud and the veil of hiring for so long, by not people not talking about salaries, people not talking about what they end up getting. Dollars in the US, you know, going back to some of the original, you know, the origins of the US, very, you know, head down, we don't talk about money. Money is not, it is there, but it's not. And therefore, the employee is at a disadvantage. But the other side of it is that, crap, I can't remember what the answer is. I had a really good thing and then I went into this.
Were you about to say, when you said we don't talk about money, that the number one song in the country this week, or
we don't talk about Bruno?
We don't talk about Bruno.
Oh, I'm way out of it.
From the movie Encanto.
You know, that's actually Disney's most popular song ever now.
Is it really their most popular ever?
Yeah. But part of it, what plays into it, is the number of languages it had already been translated into is staggering.
Oh, wow.
So the global reach of it is absolutely amazing. Hey, it's a good song.
And Dan, this movie is relatable to this conversation, because the first time I saw the movie, it was Thanksgiving weekend. All right. It just came out, visiting my brother. All right. We're in West Virginia. We drove 45 minutes with all the kids for the opening day to a theater in a very small town, watched it. I got back and I told my wife, I said, it was terrible. She goes, really? I'm like, yeah, like, what a waste to drive all the way out there. And then we get home and a week or two later, it's on Disney Plus. Now the kids want to watch it again. I have now probably watched it 200 plus times. It was on two TVs in my house this morning, one in the master bedroom because the baby wanted to watch it, and one in the other room so the kids could watch it. And I mean, they got the songs memorized and I hum the songs. And after the fifth time of watching it, I love the movie. So what does this mean? Sometimes the first time you see something, right, without understanding the culture, the songs, where the movie even takes place, I didn't understand the background of it, right? And the more I learned and the more you start to recognize the storyline of what it's talking about, you're like, wow, it's a powerful story. You know, it's a powerful commitment to family. All these other things. It's the same thing. Like sometimes that first interview is so important. And if I didn't have an agent of change, which is four kids, three of which are very little, running around my house to make daddy listen again, I would have totally given up on the movie and then been making fun of everybody who is like humming the songs while walking down the street. I am that guy now walking down the street, humming the songs.
So I've come back. I've remembered the other point. All it took was just a moment of head shaking, and there it was. So the idea that the relationship, the other interesting part about having this middle person, one, they know they have this conglomeration of knowledge of other contracts, other negotiations, other deals, and what everything is making. So they understand what a fair price is for you. But at the same time, they can also be the person who has some of the tough discussions with your organization that is not on your behalf. It's not you. At the end of the day, they walk away and you have not had to yell at somebody because you want to defend your position for a salary. Somebody else has done it on your behalf. And my question for the both of you is, do they actually walk away? I don't have an agent. I don't spend a lot of time with agents negotiating with me as a hiring manager. Do you think they walk away? And the relationship is strong between the employee and the employer after that, even if it's been a contentious set of discussions in the middle with the agent, with the middle person?
It depends.
That's my line, and I want a dollar.
I feel like it would be better. I look back on my career where I worked for the same company for 16 and a half years, and there was two different periods in that career where there was a negotiation on salary because I was offered an opportunity elsewhere and I was going to take it because it was very compelling. And the first time I was given a bunch of promises, a little bit of money, but I mean, the promises were big. Like, and I was like, well, how could I pass that up? You know, all that opportunity, right? That was a learning lesson. I didn't have an agent negotiating and, you know, I had all that glamour put in front of my eyes, right? The second time I knew better. Promises, you can break promises and you are willing to do it because you're not my immediate family and you're not my best friend. You're a company. Yep. And you report to shareholders. So forget about the promises. What can you do for me today? Right. And there was a lot more contention the second time around, 4 to 5 years later, when having that discussion because there had been a loss of trust. I did not trust what they were going to put in front of me. But this time, there was a certain person in the very top leadership position in North America, and he was willing to do a few things to make them happen. But at the same time, he did put a few things out there that said, hey, here's a few promises and remember who I am, right? And it was a little easier to take those promises from him because he was really one of the only reasons I wanted to stay at the company, right? He was in the president's role. But then 2 years later, he left the company, right? So it wasn't that he didn't fulfill the promises. He was no longer there. And that was the second thing I learned. So promises, those are great. People break them all the time, especially those which are not family and friends. So, you know, one in hand, right, is a lot more important. And then the contention part of that was, it wasn't that there was contention between the direct president and I on the negotiation. It was more, does the business not, you know, appreciate the value that I bring, right? Like whoever this person is in HR or finance that's coming up with what they are saying are the budget restrictions, right? And knowing exactly who could make these needles move, it was a little bit tough, right? And then for the next 2 years, to know that there were certain people sitting in certain board positions that I did interact with that were the ones that approved or did not approve certain things was kind of like, right. And now I'm sitting here bringing back value to the company and doing this, but you were the one that made sure I didn't get that. So it was a little bit tough that I knew that if it would have been somebody else negotiating on my behalf, I would have felt a little better being in that position.
I don't know. I mean, the reason I threw out it depends because number one, it's Dan's line. But number two, I think it really is dependent on who that person's doing it on your behalf, right? You know, look at a real estate market, right? That you could have a realtor that is a bulldog that, you know, rubs people the wrong way, and that's fine. You get what you want, but then you part ways and you and the seller buyer never speak again. So if the relationship didn't come off well, does it really matter?
Who cares at that point? Yeah.
Right. But now we're talking about something that you have to live with, and you may actually be under the shadow of that negotiation, which you had less of a hand in because you're relying on somebody else, and that may overshadow your potential career with that organization.
Yep.
You're putting a lot of trust in that individual. Me, from my perspective, you know, and I'll use the realtor market again. You know, you look at some of these pop-up companies that have come up to help you with, well, you could sell it yourself. We'll just help you with the contracts and stuff like that. I think there's a real need for that, for organizations that I can take my offer to, I can take where I'm at. Hey, I'm going to give this to you. Can you run the analysis on, is this good? What are you seeing in the market? So this is kind of the Gartner mentality, right? Because Gartner's not going to negotiate on your behalf. They are going to empower you with statistics and what they're seeing to put you back at the table and get you in the strongest position. For me, at least, I think that's the position, but I have no problem having those conversations. And I know that's not the same for everybody.
Well, you also hit on something I think it's really, really important, is that in order to do this right, that representative needs to know you. They need to know you well right. enough to be able to represent you. And in the world of movies, in the world of sports, these things happen regularly enough that they get to know you, but still have some interaction that needs some, you know, these things take time. They need, you need somebody who knows you, who has gotten to know you. And in the sports world, in the movie world, those kind of interactions in the opportunities to negotiate they happen way more frequently. You're going for a new movie or you want a new endorsement deal if you're a sports person. Yeah, so there's things that happen. So it makes it worth it for that representation to get to know you and keep knowing you. In the job market, you're not doing some kind of new negotiation every 3 or 4 months or even every year, hopefully. So it means that it means that they're not necessarily going to be as interested in getting to know you and keeping up on what's going on, because they're not going to need it as frequently, which means that they may not be as useful when they go in, or may not be as accurate in representing your actual needs when they go in to do it that once every 5, 6, 7 years.
Well, to add to that as well, as you're looking at sports and movies, that I, as the hiring manager, hiring director, I can look into your background and get to know you without your agent having to know you as well, right? As we look at sports, we love metrics. Sports are all about numbers. I can see how much time you're on the ice, how many goals you have. I can see how you throw a football. There's tons of metrics, ratios that you can look at. I mean, going back to Moneyball, right? So I know you without actually knowing you. Same thing with movies. I can watch your films. I can watch, you know, you've got interview tapes and stuff where I can get a feel for you. You really don't have that in the business sense. Now, certain roles, you could look at organizational trajectory, how organizations did, you know, if we're talking about CEOs and stuff like that. But I think at least when it comes to security, it's a bit more nebulous. And what's our metric? Hey, were you breached while you're there? No? Okay. Well, then you're good. Seriously, I mean, there's really very little you can look into. Now, granted, the three of us have a little bit more public persona because you can listen to the podcast, you can watch some of us that have webinars and videos out there. Certainly, there's a component of that, but that is a small number of people who have that kind of public profile.
And one thing I was thinking about, and kind of going back on something I said earlier when I was referring to.
There's no takebacks. You can't take that.
We certainly can't edit it out.
No. It was more along the lines of, I made a statement and I said, you know, and I was referring to an agent as more than just a recruiter. But being that I'm not in the recruiting industry, nor have I worked with a lot of different recruiters, I was reading a bunch of different articles right here, just kind of skimming through some stuff and then reading through some statistics. And there are companies out there, and I won't name them by name, that I was just reading about that specifically work first with the individual to get to know them, put them with a representative within their company. And then that person at the recruiter, whatever the organization is, they work on your behalf, right? Of going out to find the position that you were trying to look for, that, you know, in regards to what your qualifications were, and then negotiate on your behalf. And it appears they spend a little more time getting to know you. So it does sound a little bit along the lines of being an agent for you or an agent of change. But I do agree also with you, Eric, that, you know, there are people, Dan, Eric, myself included, that probably have a little more content out there publicly that somebody can look up and see, like, one, who the person is, get to know them a little bit just by hearing the things they've talked about or seeing how they handle, you know, a big stage or in front of people or presenting themselves, right? Because some of the reasons why a company would gravitate towards you is A, how you represent yourself, the company that you work for, and also, you know, the industry that you're talking about, right? So they're able to go grab that content without even talking to you directly first, right? To get to know a little bit more about you. And I think that's what some of these companies that I look at now online are trying to do. And maybe those are agents of change, and people should consider, you know, working with different recruiters, right? And then from there, how do you find then who are the trustworthy ones and who are not? And maybe that goes back also to within your own network, talking to people of, hey, please tell me, like, have you ever worked with one, you know? Because maybe you saw a friend get a really good job and had no idea that he worked with a recruiter. And just by having the conversation, he says, hey, this is who I worked with. And this was the person at that company. He was a really good representative on my behalf. And he helped negotiate, you know, because sometimes compensation isn't just about money, right? Sometimes compensation is about, you know, I was able to get all this child daycare. I was able to get some paternity leave off because, you know, my wife was pregnant. There's more to it. And those are the
rewards, they call it.
Yeah. And those are the things that also make you feel like you're more part of the company.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the word honesty, and that's not usually a term associated with agents, at least not in the public side. That genuineness, it's the do what it takes to get. Now, granted, Entourage is a fictionalization, but it's a fictionalization of a real person. And, So you also have to wonder, is this something you want to, you know, is this somebody you want to have represent you, or is this a way to approach it? And I want to take the opportunity then just start to flip to some of the challenges in this kind of a model. If you think about if you're an actor and the goal is you work at scale, you work at some, you know, predefined prices until you get good enough and that an agent will come to you and say, I will take you on. So you now have this striation between the good enoughs and the not good enoughs. So this model is pretty hefty with encouraging bias and encouraging gaps in between, encouraging the gap between the upper and the lower. And they do what they can to make the upper that much better and bigger and grander. But it certainly doesn't help those that aren't deemed worthy to come into that realm. And we have enough problems, at least in information secure in the security world, with getting those kind of that kind, reducing that kind of striation. That's a goal, you know, of many of us as leaders, is to reduce that kind of gap, not create more of it.
Right. I mean, the one thing I will say on the benefit side, and tying this back to networking, though, I mean, if you have somebody working on your behalf, and I want to say it was you, Dan, that sent me an article recently that was talking about that certain role, well, actually, we know this to be sure, certain roles within organizations do not get publicly posted. They have headhunters, there's recruiters that are going through people and usually pulling somebody that's not necessarily looking for a job. They know what the company needs. So the benefit of selecting somebody kind of working on your behalf is they've already got that back channel network and understanding what other organizations are looking for. So I definitely see that as being a benefit. What if I self-represent in the third person? Is that weird if we just have a conversation that, oh, Mr. Willie would like this? Is that too pretentious?
It depends how you do it. Hey. Are you actually doing it in person where you're able to change over
the it's sound? It's like the phone call. Hold on. I got to get my manager. Yes. Manager, Eric. Yeah.
Or it's just your own personal episode of the Many Faces of Eve. That'd be nice if you could do that. The different, you know, now 1 minute I'm Dan Ayala and the next minute I'm, Linus Johnson, super agent.
Right. Excuse me for a second. I need to confer with myself.
Linus Johnson, tech agent.
And depending on how you do that pseudo character of yourself, right? Being able to remove any empathy where it's not recognizing any fault that you've ever had, but just putting it out there. He is the greatest person ever.
Right.
Right. And then you kind of flip over and you're like, well, Boris, please, you know, there are a few things that I could say that I didn't do perfect. Eric, don't hold yourself to that. Look at what you did here and here. Be like, thank you for recognizing that. I wasn't going to bring that up, but you are right. That was great.
It's the internal good cop, bad cop.
Throw some chairs.
It would be really funny. I put in the chat line, and I'm going to be specific to the security industry here, but has the security industry helped to create a higher level of resignation amongst its, you know, in its own vertical, because people know that companies only really want to hire people with security experience, and they look around their own community and realize there's nobody left with experience. Like, hey, I can leave and go here. Hey, look at AWS is doing this. Hey, Google now is putting together an entire security platform, and we know they're willing to pay. And if you're in the Detroit area, hot flash, everybody, news alert, Google moving into the new Ford headquarters, tech hub, right downtown in the train station. How much money do you think they're dumping in there? How much do you think is going to be related to security? Yeah. Jobs.
There's
right?
There's lots of that. And the flip is that you're seeing managers, you're seeing people just continue looking for those entry-level roles and not actually changing their criteria to bring in real entry-level roles. You know, does this topic come up on every single one of our episodes? If not, it should change and actually take real entry-level people. 5 years is not entry. 5 years of experience or a CISSP is not entry-level.
So throwing this out there, I've been kind of thinking about this. So we've talked about how close-knit the community is, specifically in the Metro Detroit area in security. Everybody knows everybody. Is that actually a disservice to those that work for most of us? Because I was having this conversation recently with another CISO about an individual who worked for me. And the comment was that, yeah, I'd been looking at this person for a while, but I wouldn't try to pull him away because he works for you and we've got that relationship. do we actually, is the community working against those that work for us because of the unwillingness to go after candidates that are currently employed by people we know?
That's Midwestern. I think that's here. I think that is there's a level of deference and relationship that's here. I don't think that's necessarily the case everywhere.
Fair enough.
But there is a little bit of that. And I am not pivoting out of the conversation we're having, but I decided to go back and reread the book Kitchen Confidential and listen to it, not read it.
Wait, is that a food book, Brian, by any chance?
It is. All right. And it's narrated by Anthony Bourdain. And if you've ever heard Anthony Bourdain talk, to hear him narrate his own book, knowing that he has passed on, is really enlightening and cool. But there was something you just said there, Eric, that made me hearken to a statement that he made that applies to everywhere, right? And he goes through like 10 things that you don't ever do, right, in the industry. And he's like, if you're a liar, if you're a cheat, if you're this, you know, keep it at home, but don't ever bring it into the kitchen, right? Don't ever bring it into work, right? That, and he said, you gotta get rid of all these predisposed that you're going to work with a multitude of different characters, you know, and over 50% of them are going to speak Spanish, right? He goes, learn other people's cultures, right? You're going to work with four or five other cultures. And if you don't know a thing about their culture or their family values or everything else, you'll never be able to create that bond. He goes, the kitchen world is very small. Everybody knows each other. If you're going to pull a cook away from somebody else's shop, understand that you're putting them in a bad position, right? You may end up working for him one day, right? Like this, the other chef. So you're referring to there, you know, almost doing a disservice. In the book, he talks about when he got a shot at, you know, a bigger role at a big kitchen, as the chef de cuisine, as the executive chef, the chef de cuisine pulled him in because he got a phone call from another shop who was threatening him because he's like, you guys just pulled away like three of my cooks. What are you doing? Right? Like we kind of had this unwritten rule amongst each other, and they pull Anthony in. They're asking him the question. He's like, no, I didn't do that. He's like, yes, I did. You know what? He's like, oh my God. Like, how did he know? Right? Like how'd this person reach out? So there was kind of that unwritten rule there. And the other reason I use it as a good comparison is up until he wrote that book, right, and people started to talk about it, most people didn't realize the number of hours that people put in working in a kitchen and the cuts on the hand. Like if you sliced your hand open, you didn't go get it fixed. You wrapped it in a towel. You finished, right? When you're breached, it doesn't matter if it's Saturday, Sunday, the entire team comes in. Does the rest of the business know that? Does the front of house, does the bartender know who's already been at home that you had to sit up for six extra hours doing prep work because all of a sudden there's a party of 500 coming in on a Saturday when the kitchen's actually closed? No, nobody knows that. Only your team does, right? The people that are in the trenches, right? Hot pan, you grab it, fry your hand. That happens. Those are war wounds and scars of somebody that's been in the industry a long time. These stories are just coming out in the security world about that. Like this big hack happens. Like what and to everyone else, it's like, oh, well, good thing they just turned the computers off and turned them back on and everything worked again. No, that's not how it works. That isn't. So as I was going back there and reading the book, I'm like, there are so many good parallels to the security world. And when you brought that one up, that was one of them. You know, and he goes and talks about different levels of integrity and this and that. You know, and he talks about like, you don't ever cheat, right? The system. He goes, is it very easy for me to go to the house and have the bartender pour me, you know, the most expensive cocktail every night, you know, get one free on the house? Yeah, it's very easy to do, or make a deal with one of the purveyors, right? Which could be a vendor, right? So the vendor's getting a little kickback and you're getting a little something for the kitchen, right? No, he goes, don't ever do it. Don't sell yourself out. It matters. But until people read that book and started to realize like what the crazy life was behind the scenes, nobody ever really got it.
We'll now take a pause, brief pause for Brian's blood pressure to return to normal.
Yeah. And I'm sitting here thinking, should I yell amen? Should I do a standing ovation? That was good.
That was good. But the one thing that comes out of that is there's a difference. The kitchens are in competition with each other. We as an industry are not in competition with each other. The one thing I found, and you know, coming out of pharma, you know, in the early days of the security industry, where the pharma business is continuously in competition with each other, heavy competition, like to the point where you don't see the people get in the same room together. But the fact that the security community, the people working to secure those organizations, were always talking to each other, and oftentimes behind the scenes in ways that were done to specifically keep the business people from understanding that we're actually talking to their competition, not in anti-competitive ways, but about securing, because we have a common mission. And so, Eric, to come back to your point, I think we do a disservice when we don't encourage people to have those conversations as leaders, to say, hey, I think I could help this person grow by coming here.
I agree with
that. And I think that that is a disservice because we don't necessarily let ourselves have that conversation. Now, poaching is a different case because, you know, I've had many conversations with people in which it's, you know, hey, I'd like to take this person. I think they'd be good for my team in this way. And I said, yes, by all means, I think that's a great growth opportunity for them. I look at it as people, not as company or poaching. It's about what can I do to help that person grow the best they can.
That's a good leader viewpoint. I'm not sure that everybody shares that same viewpoint. I know we've had
No. Right. Not when you start calculating the cost to rehire and all of those things. No, there's a lot of elements that don't see it that way. Why are you why is half your team walk away to go to this other guy? Well, there was a great growth opportunities for them. It's not quite the comfortable conversation to have with the HR team at that point.
Right. Well, and at that point, I mean, let's be honest. If that is that detrimental to the team, shame on us, because that means that we weren't working on the pipeline to bring up the future, that we haven't gone through that kind of business continuity plan on, all right, who's next in line to take the role.
So throwing this out, Eric, Dan, putting you both on the spot, who is your agent? And do the comparison to say, okay, if you're in a top level management director, vice president, or CISO level in security or tech, and then if you're more at a managerial level down to security analyst, who is your agent of change, or the person you turn to, not just for advice, but also to either help negotiate on your behalf or give you the ability to do it for yourself? And you can use yourself as the example, but then remove yourself from it. And how would you give that advice to somebody else?
I mean, for me, I draw upon my network. So specifically, Dan and I have had those conversations on making moves, market, what they're seeing. That, from my perspective, that's the power of networking, right? That it's not only there when I need to make a technical decision and it's something I haven't made before, trying to figure out, you know, what have others done that was successful, but certainly from a career perspective, there are a lot of individuals around us willing to provide advice, what they've seen, what they're hearing. It's a very, very open community. So for me, it's drawing upon the network.
I'll answer, but I'm first to tell you a story. So there is, in streaming TV land, when you decide to uncheck the box that says show me personalized ads, it means you get the same ad over and over and over again. And an ad I'm currently getting while watching HGTV is from some milk council. And the question, the premise of the ad is a bunch of interns sitting around the table and they're introducing themselves for the first time. And the voiceover says, what do you do when somebody takes your fun fact for the ice breaking during an introduction of a meeting? And Eric, apparently you drink a cup of milk and it fixes it all, according to that ad. But I might need to drink a cup of milk because, Eric, you know, I'm at the same place. I'm thinking about, my network is a huge sounding block. I don't have a single place I go. I think going to a single place is limiting. You get only one perspective. I go to lots of places. I ask lots of people and try and normalize those, get that 360 degree view of what the situation is. You know, you don't get in our fields, we don't do a lot of, we're not negotiating every month. We're not doing something like this every while, but we do as hiring managers sit on the other side of it a lot. And that feeds into your experience and expertise doing it is to do when doing it for yourself. You know what you like, you know what you don't like, you know what resonates inside an organization, and you know what you can do. The problem is when you then turn and take that to a new organization, you don't necessarily know all those things. But right. You can build on the things you've learned as a hiring manager. So if you're a hiring manager, you are at an advantage because you do a fair number of negotiations like this and bringing those into play. But talk to people around you. You know, I put an article in the show notes. We should not be afraid to talk about our numbers. We should not be afraid to talk about our numbers. Talk about what you make. Talk about what your peers make. Find out the stipulations. You know, are there other creative ways that you can get things into your contract? You know, Eric, you and I have been talking for years about the idea of CISO indemnity, you know, getting clauses into your contract that maybe are non-compensation, but will help you out in the long run if something happens. That's out of your control, but you don't want to be saddled with. You know, there's a bunch of things that you can do, but it comes through conversation.
And we also have to recognize we're sitting in a data age, right? Mm-hmm. That if you go to, you know, salary.com, there's tons of sites out there that you can pay, and there's pretty small fees to get a report to look at what are the average compensation per state, per industry, per title. I mean, the amount of data that's available to us. Now, granted, you have to take everything with a grain of salt. Yeah. I mean, you look at a CISO role, it's very easy to look at an MR. Oh, look, they're $3 million a year. All right. Well,
or 94,000.
Yeah.
And everything right, in right. between. Yeah,
the full spectrum, right? So you'd have to really read through it and understand the data that you're getting, but there's a ton of data out there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's worth the investment in some of that, especially, you know, investing in yourself by either paying for some of that data and getting it and analyzing it, or having somebody help you. You know, there's a Gartner equivalent or Forrester equivalent of that kind of salary review. Go find it. I don't have one at my ready fingertips to recommend, but that'd be a cool thing.
I think some of the colleges do it too, that if you go back to where you graduated, some colleges have some of those services where they're willing to help out.
Yeah, and that's a good place to turn, because I was going to throw this back out to both of you then. Now answer the question with yourself removed, right? You guys have, Eric and Dan, a bigger network than most people, and you're involved in different community projects, whether it's the Cloud Security Alliance, Mentor Core, bunch of different organizations, right? Now take it to where the person in the audience that shows up to that event and just listens, right? And maybe only talks to one or two people the entire night. Maybe those are people at their table and they're not actually going to talk to that person again until they run into them in person, right? What does that person do? You know, his network, although maybe looks large on LinkedIn because he's connected to a lot of people, he doesn't really know all those people well enough to say, what would you do? Or he's comfortable enough of reaching out. What advice do you give them?
I would, there is no selfishness in this recommendation, but I would actually recommend that they come and come join Mentor Core. It's no cost. It's a community of people just to talk. And it's purely focused on security, privacy, compliance, ethics, what we call the guardian class, the guardians of the corporate guardian roles. And it is, we got webinars every week, but more importantly, we now have a Slack that is an open communication. It's a safe space for people to come and talk about these kind of things, career growth, compliance topics of the day, security topics of the day, sure. But it really is focused about growing leadership skills, growing your career. And we have a career advice channel where people can ask questions. I will put the link to the Slack into the show notes. It's free. Just join. Just come. We just want people to share. And mentorcore.biz is where all the webinars, podcast, video, et cetera, are. And those are all free as well. Not sponsored, right. Not biased. Well, they're biased in as much as it's Dan and my partner, Lisa Beth Lintine Walker, but that's about it. And we're biased, and that's only in our own selves. We're not sponsored.
Yeah. And I would echo that. I think that's a great way to connect, that you don't necessarily have to know the individuals, but you already know there's already a level of interest that they have in bettering the community by virtue of them being there. As well as, I mean, if you're talking about some of the young networks, the beauty of LinkedIn is being able to see kind of the rings of connections, that, you know, you're two out, you're three out. Find trusted individuals that can make some of those introductions. I mean, if you've got, you know, for instance, if you're looking to connect with Dan Ayala and you notice that, hey, I'm friends with Brian Schneely. Brian, hey, can you connect me with Dan? I think is knowing a bunch of people in the community that everybody, there's very few people that I think would push back on that and be willing to make one a warm handoff.
Yeah. And because I'm in the vendor side and I'm a filthy sales guy, I'm only going to charge 5% to make the introduction to Dan. So, I mean, that's a bargain price.
Only if you buy six licenses. I'll
I mean, no, heck, if nothing else, reach out on one of our email addresses for the podcast, right? That, yeah. Hey, you're a listener. I heard this. Can you help me out?
Feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net. And unfortunately, I'm going to tell you that email address again in just a second. Eric, Brian, we're at the end of the time. We're at the end of the hour already. I can't believe how fast this went. Thank you guys both, as always. I love these discussions, and I know the community does too. We get a lot of great feedback, but we want your feedback. And that email address again, feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net. Please email us. Tell us what you think of the show. Tell us future topics you'd like us to cover. This is not just about tech, about security for security. We don't want this to be inside baseball. We want this to be something that can be looked at from the outside in as much as it is within the community. You help us shape that. Feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net. You can find the show on your favorite podcast application. If you're listening to this, you probably already have done that. Or if you happen to be on the website, just go to your Apple Podcasts or to your Spotify or to your Pocket Casts or whatever and search for Great Security Debate. And you can subscribe there. We do have a YouTube channel as well, the video version, in which you see me look shocked every time that that something comes up, or you see Eric put his head in his hands when I respond to something silly. You can see the video version on our YouTube channel. The link will be in the show notes for the podcast, and you can always get to it from our website, www.greatsecuritydebate.net. We're elated to have you as listeners, and we can't wait to see you again on the next Great Security Debate.